I'm Tony Venables, Professor of International Economics here at the LSE, chairing this evening's proceedings. So let me welcome you all to this debate, should Britain join the Euro? As you know, we have four extremely distinguished speakers on the subject. Let me just briefly introduce them all in turn, and let me take them from the far end. So Roger Bootle, sitting on the far left on the table there, will be a familiar face to many of you from many television appearances. He's currently managing director of Capital Economics, an economic advisor to Deloitte Touche, specialist advisor to the House of Commons Treasury Committee, and visiting professor at the Manchester Business School. Sitting next to Roger is Patrick Minford, currently Professor of Economics at Cardiff University, before that Professor at Liverpool. He was one of the Treasury's panel of wise men for many years some time ago, and one of the country's leading macroeconomists. Next to him, Adair Turner, who's spoken from this stage, this platform, many times in recent years. He's senior advisor and vice chairman of Merrill Lynch, director of United Business Media PLC, chair of the Low Pay Commission, and also a visiting professor here at the LSE. And closest to me, and familiar again to many of you, Richard Layard, co-director of the Center for Economic Performance here at the LSE, and also chairman of the Economic Council of Britain in Europe. The format of the debate is going to be that we're going to give each of those speakers 15 minutes. I will endeavour to keep them fairly precisely to that 15 minutes. So they'll speak in turn for 15 minutes. Then we'll open it up to the floor for questions. I'd ask you to direct your questions to one of the speakers and try and make them fairly short and focused questions if possible. But we'll open it up to the floor for questions. Then I'll ask the speakers to wrap up very briefly their positions in turn. We're not going to have a vote. We thought about it but decided we'd spend too long trying to work out the exact wording of the motion, whether it was a matter of timing or complicated detail. We thought it'd be better to air the issues, so that there will be no vote, but just hopefully a lively and informative debate on the issues. Richard Layard is going to kick off, so let me invite him to do that.
Thank you very much. Many of you will know of the famous British newspaper headline in the 1930s, Fog in Channel, Continent Cut Off. There's still a lot of fog in the Channel. And I thought, therefore, that I would, in starting this debate off, try and give you a completely impartial review of the arguments on both sides before I reach my conclusion. So I'm going to start with the arguments in favour. The case for joining is extremely simple, which is that separate currencies fluctuating against each other inhibit trade. By contrast, if you have a single currency, that leads to deeper economic integration between the members of the single currency area. You get real specialization, and you get the kind of economies of scale that you see in the United States, which result from the single currency area that they have there. And of course, these economies of scale, this coming from huge production runs serving a very large market, mean higher living standards for the people who produce them, better hospitals, better transport systems, all the things that we want. So this is the model. The American model is, of course, the model which Europe is now trying to follow by having a single currency for itself. So then I come to my second point, which is specific to Britain in relation to this. When, before 1999, every European country had its own currency, a company that wanted to sell on the continent would consider Britain roughly as good a place in which to produce the goods that it was going to sell on the continent as anywhere else, because wherever it produced, it faced a currency barrier to get into any other country. But now, this is no longer the situation, and the result is that it is very much more convenient for somebody who is wanting to serve the continental market to be producing within the single currency area and not having to sell across a currency barrier. And the result of that is bound to make Britain less attractive compared with what we were, and to leave us poorer. Now, you can say all of that is pie in the sky, both the points I've made, and I suppose that 4 years ago it was. It was based on pure theory. It happens that it was the best theory, and that those of us who used that theory to forecast what would happen if you had a single currency area in Europe and Britain not in it, those forecasts have turned out to be absolutely correct. You can see the results on the table at the back of your sheet. Table one shows you that there has been a huge deepening of trade between France and other European countries, Germany and other European countries, and similarly if we consider other members of the Eurozone, but there has been no real deepening of trade between the UK and the rest of Europe. The result, of course, of this, that we don't have the same opportunities of trade expansion as the countries located within the Eurozone, is that a foreign investor, particularly one outside Europe, wondering where to conduct his foreign investment and to locate his production within Europe, finds Britain less attractive than he used to. So whereas in the early 90s up to 98, 40% of all the foreign direct investment coming into Europe from outside came here to serve the European market. Now it's down to 24%. That's a real big shift. Now, if we were a very high investment country, you might say it doesn't matter. I mean, we can do with our own domestically financed investment. But what many people don't realize is that Britain has always been, judged by people's willingness to invest here, a rather bad place to invest, a difficult place to invest. Look at table three, and you'll see that the investment rate in Britain, right through the 90s, I think it's true in every year in the 90s and it continues, has been subject to a lower rate of investment than France and Germany. So it's rather serious if we're becoming, as it were, even less attractive as a place to invest. So now I come to the key point. This is the most important point that I want to make this evening. It's an illusion to suppose that we have the option of just continuing as we did. We cannot say we've done all right so far, so let's just carry on and wait and see how the euro works out. Because if we do, we shall find that bit by bit, production which would otherwise be located in Britain is shifting onto the continent. And this is in fact a situation where we have been before as a nation. And I'm thinking of 1956. In 1956, if you look at the figure one in front of you, the output per head in Britain was 15% higher than in France and Germany. Incidentally, anybody who can't hear me, wave their hand. Okay. So in 1956, we were 15% richer than, or more productive than France and Germany. They then integrated into the common market. They invited us in, but we decided we didn't need to. They had extraordinary growth, and by 1973, our productivity was 15% below theirs. We then stopped the rot by joining, but as you can see from the graph, in the time since we've joined, we have not caught up. We've just held our own. And so we are still 15% behind the continent, or behind France and Germany, in output per head, and 20% behind in output per hour worked. So now we're in the position where there's another big step forward being taken in Europe towards deeper integration. And it seems to me fairly clear that unless we join, there's no chance that we would catch up. And it's rather surprising we haven't caught up, because in general there's an economic tendency to catch up, and there's a danger we might even fall behind. Now, let me just end my presentation of the pros by praising Europe, because it's not the conventional thing to do. Europe is not the basket case that you read about in the English press, as you can see if you happen to go there. It's an extraordinary success story, starting way behind the United States. Northern Europe has caught up with US productivity per hour. Over the last 10 years, and these facts are not well known, over the last 10 years, we have seen income per head growing at roughly the same rate in Europe as in the United States and as in Britain. So it's all on a par now. The blot, of course, on the European landscape, especially, I think, scandalous, is France and Germany, is unemployment. France 8%, average of France and Germany 8% or over, us 5%. But this is not due to some general feature of their economy. It's due to mistaken treatment of unemployed people, which I and Patrick and others have inveighed against for many years without very much success. It's a complete fallacy to suppose that we, with our labour market, would import the unemployment of France and Germany with theirs. The most obvious evidence for that is that Netherlands and Ireland, as you can see, sorry, I haven't given the figures, the Netherlands and Ireland, with 3%, 3.5% Netherlands, 4% Ireland, have less unemployment than ourselves. Unemployment is determined by local labour market institutions, and it's not imported through joining a single currency. So let me now move briefly to the argument against, which is this. If you lose your exchange rate, you lose your interest rate. Now, I want to point out first, I've already pointed out in relation to the microeconomic arguments, I want to point it out now in relation to the macroeconomic issue. The loss of the exchange rate is itself an advantage. It's an advantage not to have a floating exchange rate, because a floating exchange rate is and has been a major source of shocks to our competitiveness, i.e. to what I call in figure 2 the relative price of British goods. And you can see there that the movement of the exchange rate, which is the bottom line, far from stabilizing the top line, which is our competitiveness, is the main reason why the top line is so wiggly. We would have done very much better in terms of our competitiveness if all of Europe had been, for example, on the DM. And this is just a hypothetical illustration in the next chart, figure 3, which shows you in the line which starts and ends at the bottom, below the other line, which is the same one you've seen before, you can see how much more stable the value of the currency when trade weighted would have been if the whole of Europe had been on the DM, contrary to the arguments that are sometimes put that because the DM fluctuates against the dollar, that would have been a very unstable situation. The reason, of course, that our trade-weighted exchange rate would have been more stable is that most of our trade is with Europe, as you can see from Table 4, that our trade with the USA is only 16% as compared with 50% with Euro land. So the loss of exchange rate is no great loss, but the loss of the interest rate is. And I would just like to compare our situation as it would be if we joined with that of Texas, because Texas, of course, is part of a single currency area, and it manages. Why? Now, one feature in favor of the Texan situation is it has more labor mobility between it and the rest of the US than there is between the UK and the rest of Europe. But on the other hand, they have a tremendous disadvantage. They can't have any active fiscal policy. In fact, they're forced to operate their fiscal policy in the wrong direction by their budget rule, which means that in recessions, taxes have to rise or public spending to fall. We will have our budget where they don't. So my conclusion is that if Texas can manage with its advantage and disadvantages compared with us, so can we. And as far as I know, there's no one in Texas who actually wants a separate Texan currency. Although, of course, at some times they would think, how nice if we could have our own interest rates. The reason they don't want a separate currency is they know the exchange rate would wander all over the place in a completely undesirable way. Texas is, incidentally, an oil-rich country like Britain, and oil countries are particularly vulnerable to undesirable fluctuations in the exchange rate. So the conclusion that I reach on the exchange rate is that because the world has now, partly due to the efforts of Patrick and Roger and others who differ from us on this, has become a very low inflation world, the only case that existed for separate currencies was to enable the exchange rate to adjust to offset the inflation differential. Now that our friends on the other side have been so successful, why can't they celebrate their success, realize the redundancy of a separate currency, and come and support the euro? As regards the arguments, this is my last summary sentence, the macroeconomic arguments have pros and cons in them. The loss of the exchange rate, good, the loss of the interest rate, bad. But the microeconomic arguments are completely one-sided, and I believe they are the overwhelming ones. And what they say is this: if you seriously want to be rich, join the euro. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Richard. Patrick Minford.
Well, I really enjoyed those remarks, Richard. Good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for coming and listening to this so far very one-sided debate. I worked it out that the pros were all pros and the cons were also pros in Richard's. So there we are. Well, I'm going to... I must say that I liked Richard's charts, and I thought they demonstrated clear causality testing had been carried out. And I thought also that his dismissal of the whole of monetary economics in the statement that we didn't really want to have an independent monetary policy or an independent exchange rate, quite clearly, in the modern world, was rather breathtaking. Richard was reminding me, we've debated in this chamber before about unemployment and on other things. And I'm glad to say that on these topics, though, we've had a great deal of convergence. I'm hoping that on this one there will also be convergence, on his part, that is. Now, this debate is not about politics, for a simple reason, that the political case for the euro can't be settled in the sense of persuading one side to cross over to the other. Those that are in favour of greater European political integration are in favour of the euro as an instrument of that. And this was very apparent in the debate or non-debate on the continent about the euro, in which basically anyone who as I did on one or two occasions with Germans and French and Italians and so forth, raised economic issues about the euro project was dismissed as being not quite on message. Didn't I realize that this is a political project? So clearly there is a political case for the euro, and it's very apparent among those that favor the euro that they are quite impatient when you talk about the economics with your failure to understand the political case. Of course, those against political integration in Europe and in favor of a Europe of cooperating states are opposed to the use of the euro as an instrument of unification, and so therefore are against the euro in that sense. Now, of course, it is the case that in the UK, unlike across the channel, the fog having momentarily lifted, so we could see our friends across the channel, where there is a strong political support for the euro. Here, of course, the situation is that there is very little political support for the idea of a federal Europe, a unified, politically integrated Europe. And therefore, of course, the debate in this country is exclusively about the economics, because you can be in favor of a Europe of cooperating states and nevertheless be in favor of the euro for monetary reasons. Well, now, it's for that reason that the debate in this country, which is the only place there's been a debate really about the euro, apart from Sweden, which is still not in the euro, the reason it's about economics is because there is an economic case to be made for going into the euro, and that has to be made. It can't be made on political grounds. Now, Richard has put the economic arguments pro and con, and of course, as Martin Wolf this morning in the Financial Times said, the case for joining the euro on economic grounds had better be clear and unambiguous in order to persuade the vast majority of British people who are pretty Euro-sceptical about the wider political agenda. It had better be clear and unambiguous in order to persuade them that there is a good economic reason. Now, what are these pro reasons? Well, they're micro. And indeed, the pro is a micro case. It's a case about transactions costs, which Richard didn't mention, but it's a pretty weak argument, so it's quite a good reason he didn't mention it, I suppose. The EU produced a study showing that the transactions costs of not changing currency would save in an advanced country with an advanced banking system maybe 0.1% of GDP, and that would probably decline the more people use electronic means of settling deals. And of course, the House of Commons, I think it's the Trade and Industry Committee, came up with a one-off cost for the UK of converting to the euro, whose present value is more or less exactly the same as that, possibly a little bit larger. So the transactions argument, cost argument, is an argument that's been put, but is rather weak. Another argument is exchange rate uncertainty, and I'll come back to that because that's the core of it. The third argument is from transparency. That's another micro argument, that it'll facilitate transparency in price comparison. And sort of money is an efficient unit of account if you're in a border area. The problem is, of course, that for the UK, and I want to emphasize, and Roger and I want to emphasize, that we're not making the case for the euro for other countries, whether on political or economic grounds. It's very much of a numbers case for applied to the UK. And in the case of the UK, the transparency argument is peculiarly weak because we do not have common border areas like a Belgium or a Netherlands, where people, quite large numbers of people, are crossing borders on a regular basis, and for whom the inconvenience of conversion of prices out of one currency into another is extreme. We have just one land border, which is in between Northern and Southern Ireland, and now it's mainly populated by cows. So the transparency argument is pretty weak too for the UK. Now I come to the core of the micro argument, which is about exchange rate uncertainty. And here Richard, you know, has blown this up into a huge barrier to trade and investment, and presumably also to capital flows. At one point, it was suggested that it would have a big effect on interest rates because of the risk premium. But what we've discovered is, if you've got a sane monetary policy set up, as we now have, thank goodness, with the Monetary Policy Committee, your risk premium disappears and becomes very comparable with anybody else's risk premium. So it's pretty clear that in terms of monetary flows, this exchange rate uncertainty is not a source of problems. What about trade and investment? Well, Roger is going to deal with some of the extraordinary numbers that Richard produced. Well, not extraordinary numbers, I should say, but extraordinary inference from them. I'll say on the basis of subtle causality tests that are not exactly apparent to me. But just looking at the case in terms of the sorts of evidence about the effects of exchange rate uncertainty on trade and investment, on real things, it's pretty hard to find. The IMF, which is in the business of wanting to abolish exchange rates, and has been for very many years, has a great shed full of studies on the issue. And the answer is basically that they can find very little either way. Sometimes it embarrassingly goes the wrong way. If you look at more, a great fuss was made by a study by Andrew Rose, the University of Berkeley, California. And in that, he used a gravity model. He found that if you joined a monetary union, you'd triple your trade with the country that you joined with. But this has been universally criticized by other economists because it drew on the experience of tiny little dependent countries in monetary unions with mother countries, and is riddled with the sorts of problems of panel data that need very careful dealing with, selection bias, and the fact, how do you disentangle the fact of general political closeness from the effects of monetary union? If you look at cases where we can get at some evidence, when Singapore broke up with Malaysia, for example, or when Ireland in 1979 broke up with the UK, you find, and there's a very careful study by Walsh and Tom, looking at the Irish case, you find no evidence that the breaking of a currency union has any discernible effect on trade. And of course, this is incredibly likely, because if exchange rate uncertainty creates a barrier, it's likely to be very, very small relative to other barriers to trade. Now, that's the sort of theory of it, very briefly. But what about the practice in the UK's case? Well, now, Richard talked as if we were just a little offshore island of the European Union, but this isn't true. We are a major global trader and investor. We have enormous links with the United States. If you look at a weighted basket of our trade in goods and services and investment flows, you find that far more than half our flows are with the nut outside the euro area. We are a global player. And if you look at whether, and this is where currency union is, it's not like joining a world currency. You're deciding to join one group of players rather than another group of players. Now, if you're a global trader and investor, this doesn't make a lot of sense. If I could show you a chart of the euro versus the dollar, I'll use the Deutschmark before the euro became created, and go back to 1980, you would see that the euro against the dollar had fluctuated enormously. The dollar first rose in the 80s, in the early 80s, and then it plunged. It rose about 50%, then it plunged 50%. And then it sort of wobbled around and rose a bit and fell a bit. And then, of course, it rose against the dollar against the euro when in the run-up to the euro being launched and subsequently. Now it's falling again. Now, in this world of, you know, regional currencies, would you, as a global currency player, wish to link to one or other end of that seesaw? It makes no sense to link to either. And in fact, what we've done quite successfully is by linking to neither, we sort of floated in between. When one's gone up a lot, we've gone down against it and up against the other. When the other's gone up a lot, we've gone down against it and up against the other. And that has allowed us to stabilize our situation in the face of enormous, if you like, shocks from these two tectonic plates, the euro area and the dollar area, rubbing up against each other. And we did a big study of this a year ago. I've introduced some numbers here from stochastic simulations of macro models. And what we found was actually for the UK, using our forecasting model, which we operated for 20 years, if you inject it into the euro area, in fact, by linking it to that one end of the seesaw, the euro end of the seesaw, overall exchange rate instability slightly rises. Because, of course, although you close down uncertainty against the end of the seesaw you're going up and down with, you massively increase the uncertainty against the other side. So what we're talking about here is, do we want to choose, as a global trader and investor, to join one end of an incredibly volatile seesaw, and thus, as it were, close down one bit of risk and open up a huge other basket of risks? I think the answer is very clearly not. And now if I can go on, so the point about these micro-arguments, you've got to look at them very carefully in this world of regional currency union. They're not quite as clear-cut as they look. It may be you're closing down uncertainty against one bunch of players, but you're massively increasing it against another. And that brings me to the macro-arguments, which are all, of course, solidly against, and where the Treasury, as we confidently expect, will have been acutely frightened and will want to say no. Because, of course, if you are trying to run a monetary policy, one thing you desperately need is a floating exchange rate. Otherwise, you obviously don't have an independent monetary policy. And again, we did some study of this. We took our model and we plunged it in the euro area. Others have done the same. And it's not surprising to find that when you close off one of your major instruments, namely your ability of monetary policy to stabilize the economy, you get a massive increase of macro variability, boom and bust, as our revered and adored Chancellor would say. And nobody likes that. It's very politically unpopular. Elections are fought over it, as we've seen in this country. And our calculation is it an index of macro uncertainty rises about 75% if you go into the euro area. Now, of course, there's all sorts of things that might happen if you're in the euro area. You might magically have massive labor mobility. You might be able to invent some budgetary mechanism that is very helpful for Texas, which, of course, have the automatic fiscal stabilizers, which Richard didn't mention. But none of those things happen, of course, in the European area. And the Eurozone is completely devoid of stabilizers, as we all know very well. And that's why, in this study that we carried out, we found this massive, pragmatic, undeniable rise in macro instability. Now, I'll just rapidly mention a couple of other things that give one pause in the macro area. One is that harmonization is an immensely alarming phenomenon. Now, Europe may be a wonderful place. Just give me one second, Mr. Chairman. Europe may be a wonderful place, and Richard may be in love with it. But I have to say, high taxes, high social regulation, and so forth, is not a recipe for competitiveness. And maybe harmonization, which is appealed to as necessary to make the euro work, may not be such a good idea. And finally, the fact that the continent has a bunch of bankrupt state pensions doesn't fill me with confidence. And bailout is quite a big problem of monetary unions. This is an area where I think we should be very leery of potential bailout. So, ladies and gentlemen, my pros are all moderately con, and my cons are very highly con. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. Adair Turner.
Well, thank you, Chairman. I think that this debate comes at an interesting time in the overall debate about the euro within the UK, because I think it is fairly obvious that the immediate prospects of us going in after a referendum this year are pretty slight. And indeed, it would be my judgment that they may well be slight of us going in before the next general election. And although for those of us who are in favour, that is in some senses a disappointment, I think it does clear the air for a debate like this, because it means that we don't have to get involved in the minutiae of whether or not we believe that the five economic tests have been met, something about which I breathe a sigh of relief, because I find the five economic tests sometimes a form of a metaphysics rather than economics. But we can turn to what we believe is the fundamental case for going into the euro, and we can debate whether, absent the fact that we're going in this year or at all soon, do we believe that our objective as a country should be in principle to get into the euro and to deal with any problems that we see in the present a structure of the euro system, or do we believe that we should take the opportunity of the fact that we're not going to go in this year to say, well, let's put it aside, not merely for the short term, but for the long term as well. I think our best policy in the present environment is to have a clear objective that we will go in at some stage, but to recognize the problems that exist within the current euro project and to be committed to trying to fix those problems ahead or after going in. And to make that point, I would like to do a mix of reiterating some points that Richard made, and he did very successfully take all of the key arguments in favor and condense them into 15 minutes, and to pick up some of the points that Patrick made. I think what's interesting about the debate is that there's a degree across this debate of agreement, at least on the structure of it. And the agreement is that in favour are a set of micro supply side arguments, but there's a debate about how big those are in favour. But the fact that the micro supply side arguments are in favour is in theory not disputed. And then there are a set of macro arguments where there is a straight trade-off, where people have different points of view between the disadvantages of a one-size-does-not-fit-all interest rate and the potential advantages of fixed exchange rates. On the micro-supply-side case, I loved the way that Patrick dived into the argument that we didn't make and we weren't going to make about transaction costs, because I think any reasonable person who has looked at this debate has rapidly come to the conclusion that the transaction costs are not a reason for going in, and that the transition costs of the new ATMs are all against, are almost as trivial an argument against as the transactions are in favour. So I think we can probably agree from now on that transaction and transition costs are just separate from this debate, and we won't mention them again. The key micro and supply side case is that a single currency helps to complete and make more intensive a single market of intense competition and freedom of barriers to the movement of capital and trade. It makes it easier to trade because there is no exchange rate risk. It removes one of the causes of risks. It makes easier to invest because you have removed a cause of risk. And it means that you don't have to do away with economies of scale in the pursuit of natural hedges. You don't have to, simply because you have revenue in Spain, put a bit of your cost base in Spain as a natural hedge against that. You can design your business systems across Europe on a pan-European least cost basis, as they do in the US, and as is a key element in the US's productivity advantage vis-a-vis Europe. And finally, there's the issue of price transparency, where the thing I would say in response to Patrick's point about the lack of our contiguous frontier is that I am convinced that the most important issue on price transparency is not actually consumer price transparency, it's price transparency in all sorts of categories of intermediate goods which are traded between business, where there are enormous differences caused by exchange rate variations. You can see this because there just isn't a law of one price. When the exchange rate moves, you do not get an immediate movement in the list price or the actual price of an intermediate good sold in sterling and in euro to equalize that. And that suggests that there would be a major benefit in increasing the intensity of competition in intermediate, far more than end consumer goods, from price transparency. Now, the trouble with all those debates is, how big are they? And Patrick had a set of detailed figures that showed that they were very small. But actually, there is at least one good study, and it is a study which both has mathematical facts, but also you can go and see it the moment you visit there, which has pointed out that if you look at Canada and the US, a Canadian province is 20 times more likely to trade with another Canadian province which is equidistant than with an American state which is equidistant. Now, that may be some natural cultural preferences at work there as well, but almost anybody who's looked at it, I think, ends up believing that this is heavily driven by the noise that exchange rate movements put into the processes of trade and the processes of investment. So I believe, from the point of view of a sort of business person, having looked at the way that people make investment and trade decisions, but also looking at the studies that have been done, that the micro supply side argument for the completion of a single market is an important argument overall. What Patrick is quite right in saying is, once you've made that argument in favour of a single currency in theory, you have to think very carefully about which single currency you are joining. And if it was the case that we had one block to which we focused 50% of our trade, and another block, also a unified currency block, where there was 50% of our trade, it would be a difficult choice to make. But the point is that when Patrick said the figures, that over half of our trade was outside of the European Union. And again, we could get into a debate about which precise figures to look at. I think the best figures to look at are trade in goods and services, but not including investment flows. But we can come back to that rather technical issue if we want in the questions. But on the basis of goods and services, it is 50% to Europe, and it's about 15 or 16% to the nearest next block, which is the US, and then there's a lot of other blocks. And therefore, you're not choosing between 50 and 50. You have the option of tying your exchange rate certainly against 50%, and none of the other blocks is an attractive one. And I think also it's worthwhile saying that I simply do not agree with, and I don't think the figures support, Patrick's assertion that by fixing against the Euro block, we increase our volatility against other currencies. Now, the tricky point here is that the only way we can debate this is to spend several hours in debate in which we all get out our models and you all test whether the numbers are right or not. But I would say that in the document that Richard and I produced together, Why Britain Should Join the Euro, there is a calculation, figure 3 on page 11, where we did a calculation which suggested clearly that if Britain had been part of a hypothetical European currency since 1979, we would have actually significantly decreased our overall currency volatility rather than increased it, as Patrick was suggesting. And that's not very surprising when you just think anecdotally and think back to some of the movements which have occurred. If you look at the relationship of sterling versus dollar and Deutschmark versus dollar in the early 80s, which was one of the biggest periods of exchange rate volatility, you just have to draw out the chart to notice that the Deutschmark was much more stable against that oscillating dollar between 79 to 85 than sterling was, which was oscillating against both the Deutschmark and against the dollar. And indeed, the interesting thing about that period is, if we had linked ourselves to the Deutschmark during that period, we'd have been more stable against the dollar as well as totally fixed against the Deutschmark. Now, that had a lot to do with the petrocurrency status of the UK sterling at that time. So on this macro argument, where we accept entirely, on those who are in favour, that there is a trade-off between a one-size-does-not-fit-all interest rate and the benefits of fixed exchange rates, I do think that the benefits of fixed exchange rates are clearly on the positive side of the camp. Let me then pick up one or two other things, because I think Richard did very effectively set out most of our arguments. And I just want to pick up some arguments which are made against, and again which Patrick mentioned right at the end there when he was sort of slipping things in extra time. He talked about the dangers of a social policy harmonisation and of bankrupt pension funds. Can I just say something on pension funds? I'm wearing another hat here because I am chairman of an independent pension commission. It is one of the great macroeconomic fallacies of all time to imagine that there is a fundamental macroeconomic difference between a system of funded pensions and a system of unfunded pensions, as long as the funded pensions are not invested overseas. Only to the extent that your funded pensions are invested overseas does the process of funding change the fundamental macroeconomics that the working population in any generation supports the retired population. All that funding versus unfunded does is change the direction of the financial flows, but within one way or another, the working population produces a value added which flows to the benefit of the retired population. As it happens, we are in a better position than Italy, but it's got absolutely nothing to do with funded versus unfunded. It's got to do with more British babies than Italian babies. I think the other point to make is that I simply do not believe that there is any possibility, it's clearly legally excluded, but I've never seen the transmission mechanism explained, whereby by entering the euro, we are at all opening ourselves up to the ownership of the unfunded liabilities of the Italian state. Again, we can discuss that in pensions, but I think that is one of these things which is simply thrown into this debate, which really has almost nothing to do with the rational argument, which is really that macro trade-off between one-size-fits-all interest rates and fixed exchange rates. The other thing to say is this point about harmonization of social policy. Patrick didn't say it, but I could almost hear him. I'm sure in a little bit more extra time he'd have got to harmonization of tax rates as well, because once you get going on harmonization of social policy, you sort of get addicted and you go on to the next stage, which is harmonization of tax rates. The argument is that by going into the euro, you have to buy into a whole set of other policies. I think the key thing to realize is this is wrong. We can pick and choose. We can make choices. Let me illustrate it on taxation. There is nothing about going into the euro which changes the ability of France to run tax and spend at about 50% of GDP and Ireland to spend tax and spend at about 35% of GDP. There is no rule within the way that the euro is set up. There is no necessity of macroeconomic demand management that requires you to harmonize those overall levels of tax burden. And insofar as there is an argument put forward in Europe that we should harmonize in order to prevent a race for the bottom, that is an argument which has been unleashed by the existence of free movement of capital and labor, and is an argument completely separate from, though very interesting, but completely separate from, the issue on the ECB. And the way to realize that is to think about the debate about the withholding tax, where the Germans wanted to have us harmonize withholding taxes on euro bonds. Was that unleashed by the existence of monetary union? Well, no, it wasn't, because German citizens could invest in euro bonds legally held in Luxembourg, whether in Deutschmarks or in French francs or in Belgian francs, long before there was a euro. It was the free movement of capital and labor, which all those who are against the euro tend to say, but no, I'm still in favor of that, which unleashes the argument about whether or not we should have tax harmonization. I don't think it establishes a good argument for tax harmonization, but some people might think it does. But either way, it is an issue tangential to, separate from, a separate debate from the argument about whether or not we join the euro. Britain could be in favor of tax harmonization and could accept tax harmonization in or out of the euro, and we can be against, and successfully against, tax harmonization in or out of the euro. And the same is true about social policy. There is nothing about going into the euro which changes either the economic dynamics or the constitutional legal dynamics of whether or not we agree to further measures of social policy harmonization. Let me end by saying that I think what I've tried to do, not completely, is to pick up some of, I think, the red herrings that the opponents sometimes introduce into this debate. But let me finally end by saying that I think there is one big problem within the euro at the moment, and that is that there is a danger that we have a system that has an element of deflationary bias, and that deflationary bias derives from the combination of the Stability and Growth Pact, the debt positions with which some countries entered the euro, where they did not go far enough in consolidation of debt before going in, and that can dangerously constrain the operation of automatic fiscal stabilizers. I don't think that's an argument against us going in, because actually, of all the countries in Europe, we are in one of the best positions in terms of our accumulated stock of debt and our freedom to use automatic fiscal stabilizers. But I do think that it is a major issue for Europe. Faced with those fiscal constraints, I think the burden of adjustment falls very heavily on the monetary side, and that it is therefore regrettable that the ECB has not adjusted, taken on board the positive and symmetric inflation targets, which I think are the key defense in any system against deflation, which we have in the Bank of England. What I'm therefore suggesting is that the best British policy at the moment is for us to have a clear commitment to enter the euro, but to be arguing very strongly for making sure that it is a euro run with symmetric inflation targets, such as we have very sensibly introduced in the Bank of England 6 years ago. Thank you very much.
good, thank you. The final speaker, Roger Bootle.
Well, thank you, Chairman. It's a great pleasure to be asked to speak to you this evening on this interesting subject. I was very struck by Professor Layard's charming introduction, and in its spirit, let me tell you that my role here is to give you a completely impartial account of the arguments against. I was very struck also by the way that Adair Turner managed to sneak in some pretty amazing concessions in what I prefer to call injury time, and I'll try to address some of those as I go along. But let me start by establishing some perspective. Listening to Richard Layard, you'd think that European economy was an amazing success story. In fact, of course, the facts tell you something really very different. Forget the level of productivity, which is the result of a whole series of developments over a long period of time. Look at the macro numbers, the recent macro numbers. They are a euro disaster. The 10 years, 1993 to 2002, the UK grew by 2.8%, the eurozone by 1.9%, France by 2%, Germany by only 1.3%. Since the euro was formed in 1999, the figures are as follows. The UK 2.4%, the eurozone 2.1%, Germany 1.5%. Indeed, Britain has experienced the longest period of sustained economic growth for half a century. Now, I'm not going to suggest to you that these differences are all due to the fact that they are in the euro and we are not, or even that they're due to the fact that they prepared to get into the euro for a long time and we did not. However, I think to ignore the euro altogether as a factor in all this would be bizarre. Now, Richard Layard admitted that there is a problem, indeed so did Adair Turner, with the so-called one-size-fits-all monetary policy, and they both pretty much blithely dismissed it. We heard some airy-fairy stuff about transactions costs and all that sort of business. Let's focus on what the costs of a one-size-fits-all monetary policy really are. There's nothing airy-fairy about this at all. It's there, staring you in the face, in the shape of the German predicament. Now, there were also some, generous acknowledgements by Adair Turner at the end about deflation. It is a serious problem. And it's a serious problem which is systematically created by the way the Eurozone functions in relation to Germany's problems. Germany's difficulty is that it needs a lower level of real interest rates. And yet without an independent interest rate of its own, it can't get that. It lands up, therefore, with a depressed economy. What does the depressed economy do? Well, of course, it produces lower rates of inflation, which raises the real interest rate, which depresses the German economy still more. In other words, Germany is locked into a position where it must face adjustment through deflation. That is the way the system will work. And it's a very painful way of adjustment indeed. Meanwhile, of course, in other parts of the Eurozone, you have countries with pretty high rates of inflation, Netherlands, Spain, and Ireland, facing very different situations. Now, this is not something, frankly, that can be blithely dismissed. It is fundamental and real, and it's extremely dangerous. It was highlighted very recently, indeed, by Martin Feldstein. Some of you may have seen the article in the FT. Now, by contrast, monetary policy in the UK has recently been working extremely well. Let's be clear about this. The MPC system has been a raging success. Nor should we regard it simply as a flash in the pan, one of Gordon's creations. I do give him great credit for it and its structure and its setup, but frankly, it followed in the wake of something that came before it, namely the adoption of inflation targeting in the wake of the ERM abandonment and what came to be known as the Ken and Eddie show. We've had a long period now of successful monetary policy in the UK. Now, by contrast, the ECB does not work well, and I think admitted that very, very generously. The ECB does not work well. It's not transparent, it's not fully accountable, and its monetary policy is badly formed. Equally, the Stability and Growth Pact in its current form is a monstrosity. Now, there is a view that these are minor details, as Adair would say, minor details to be sorted out later. They're just little things that are wrong and they can be corrected. However, I don't think this argument stands up to serious scrutiny. The difficulties, the problems in the structure and operation of monetary policy are the systematic result of bad structure, of having to pander to the interests of umpteen different countries, large and small, and of trying to use monetary policy as the forcing house of political union. Whereas, by contrast, to function well, monetary policy requires political union and effective political union to be there in the first place. Moreover, these problems, which have been evident from the beginning, are going to become incomparably worse when the new accession countries join the union. Now, interestingly, I think very little of this account of the difficulties, dangers, and costs would be news to a large number of people on the continent. In France and Germany, in the run-up to the formation of the euro, it was a commonplace to argue and to accept that forming the euro, joining the euro, would have economic costs. That was widely accepted. The argument was that those costs would be worthwhile, set against the substantial political gains. It's only because in this country the political case simply can't effectively be made that people have been focusing on the supposed economic case in favour. Why then, bearing in mind those arguments, is there so much enthusiasm for joining in some quarters? Well, there are several reasons. One, I think, is that, well, it's another example of the tendency of a certain sort of Englishman to believe that the solution to any major problem is to join a club. Now, I suppose I could dignify that in some ways. In the Foreign Office in particular, I think officials are succumb to what I've dubbed top table syndrome. That's to say, they honestly believe that economic prosperity emerges as the result of detailed negotiations, hard bargaining between clever chaps like themselves and their political leaders, well-briefed and motivated, smoke-filled rooms, all that stuff. Out comes the treaty or the arrangement which brings prosperity. Rather, and it's important, therefore, that you get a place at the top table at those various gatherings, rather than believing what seems to me to be self-evident and what I think all of economics teaches, that in fact it's the outcome of the hard grind of millions of ordinary people properly motivated. Now, this may make it sound as I am in danger of being a bit like Groucho Marx, who, you know, famously said that he wouldn't care to belong to any club that would have him as a member. But having listened to the arguments on this debate for some considerable time, and indeed having listened to them this evening from Adair and Richard, let me make a confession to you, and it may come as something of a surprise. I'm all in favour of the euro. Patrick registers some. Yes, I am. I'm all in favour of it. For them! Or rather, to be more accurate, for some of them. This is, I think, a critical point which Patrick touched upon. Being against Britain joining the euro doesn't mean to say that you think that the whole thing should be reversed, that it's a disaster necessarily for all the countries that have joined it. I don't believe that. It seems to me that for many of the countries it's been a great success. For a country like Belgium, which is so small that it has little hope of running an independent monetary policy successfully, it's a good thing. For a country like Italy, which has a history of monetary mismanagement, it's a good thing. For a country like Greece, which is in both those positions simultaneously, it's a good thing. But we are not in this position. Nor is it, in my view, nor is this a wholly selfish view. I'm all right, Jacques, as it were. It's not simply that. I genuinely believe that actually, by staying out, Britain will benefit the countries of the Eurozone as well. Policy competition, by running our policy better, I think will exert more pressure on the Eurozone to improve the structure of its policy making. I've hinted at some of the reasons why I think some people are still strongly in favour. I haven't closely touched on some of the arguments that were addressed by Richard Layard. Let me now quickly do that. I think there can easily be a gross misinterpretation of the evidence on trade and foreign direct investment, and I think Richard, in his numbers, is in danger of that. He quotes the figures that are now well known, purporting to show that the UK's trade with the Eurozone has stagnated or fallen. As a share of GDP, it's gone nowhere, whereas France and Germany's has risen. These figures should be treated with the utmost caution. It should come as no surprise to learn that during this period, the pound rose by about 15% against the euro. I think this is the main reason why the trade figures have taken the turn that they have. Moreover, Richard didn't mention that although, according to those numbers, the trade of France and Germany with other members of the Eurozone over this period did rise quite a lot, and he's suggesting that's because of the euro. Interestingly, over the same period, it rose even more with countries outside the euro. Now, was that due to the wonders of transparency and confidence, all these things? I know the euro is marvellous, but is it that marvellous? What's more likely, I think, is that, again, this is due to the fact that the euro was actually pretty weak. And then there's the fact that these figures refer only to goods. They very conveniently omit services, but I'll give you the figures. In 1999 and 2000, exports of services to other members of the EU, Denmark, another out, recorded the largest increase. The UK's figure was 2.1 against an EU average of 0.1, and the figures for Germany and Italy were down 2.6 and 3% respectively. Foreign direct investment. Here I must make a concession. It does look as though from recent figures the UK has been losing its share of foreign direct investment coming into the EU. Eurostat data shows the following. In 1998, the UK's share was 56%. In 2001, it was down to 24%, compared to 6% for Germany and 9% for France. These figures, though, should be treated with the utmost caution. For a start, 1998 is an extremely peculiar year. It's a UK peak and a trough for France and Germany. Moreover, typically, between 40 and 50% of the UK's FDI comes from America. Now, America's had a few problems over the last few years, you know, and it's not surprising that it should have reduced the amount of foreign direct investment coming into Europe and other places, and the UK would have been particularly hard hit by that. Then there's the distortion from M&A activity. M&A activity is included within these figures. There's a great temptation to think that FDI refers to greenfield site investment in manufacturing. It doesn't. It includes M&A. Now, the year 2000, for instance, was a bumper year for investment into Germany, FDI into Germany. Unfortunately, 92% of this represented the takeover of the German company Mannesmann by the British company Vodafone Airtouch, which generated not a single job or amount of real investment in the German economy at all. Then the series is supremely erratic. In 1994, the UK's share of inward direct investment fell below France's and Germany's, only to bounce back within a few years to record levels. And let's not get FDI out of perspective. There is this great temptation to think, you know, vast amounts of FDI without which we couldn't function, much of it coming in from Asia, car plants and all the rest of it. How will we get by without it? Well, the figures are quite striking. The flow of FDI into the UK runs at between 2 and 9% of GDP. It is quite erratic. The idea of Japanese car plants not coming in or leaving, well, really, this is very old hat. Over the 10 years, 1992 to 2001, the percentage of inward investment into the UK coming from Japan was less than 1%. Then there's the figure that Richard and Adair talked about with regard to half or more than half of the UK's trade going to Europe. Well, this is partly true, half true. It depends, frankly, what you look at, and they were fair about this. If you look at goods, then it's rather more than that. If you look at services, it's a good deal less. If you look at investment flows, it's a good deal less. And it's by no means obvious to me that one should only look at goods, and indeed I would argue that you should look at the whole lot. Now, there's one argument which I think is pretty important for a number of people, although I would concede it was not made by my opponents today, and that's to say that the euro, when it comes to the end, is inevitable. We must join it. I've heard this argument on a number of occasions, and it then takes the form, well, if we're going to have to join it anyway, we might as well join it now. I have to say, I do find this really pretty unpalatable. Economists have an appalling record at forecasting whether the simplest variable is going to go up or down. So pronouncing inevitabilities, frankly, I don't think falls to them. The idea that it's inevitable, I think, really hinges on this idea about trade and the proximity, trading goods and the proximity of the continent. But really, this verges on the economically illiterate. The proximity argument does depend upon the importance of trade in physical goods. And yet, if we know anything about the world, we know that surely trade in physical goods is becoming less and less important, and that for high-tech services, which are becoming more important, frankly, distance is irrelevant. The idea that we've got to enter a monetary, let alone a political union, with countries that happen to be geographically closest to us recalls the pre-industrial revolution situation for just about everyone felt they had to marry someone from their own village. Meanwhile, the growth performance of the Eurozone, looking further out, is, I think, likely to be very disappointing. This is an area of falling population in contrast to the United States. The share of world trade and world production accounted for by the Eurozone is likely to fall, and therefore there seems to be no compunction at all why we should regard tying into the Eurozone as being supremely important. Now, lastly, let me wrap this up by going back to the point about macro policy. If we were to join the Euro, we would be giving up the most successful monetary policy regime, I suspect, that we've ever had in our history, something that's widely regarded as probably the best in the world, and we would be doing that in favour of taking up a pig in a poke. That is a gamble which no rational person should want to take.
I think all the panelists are itching to get at one another, but they're going to have to wait. We'll take questions and comments for half an hour or so. There are some microphones going round, I hope. If questioners could please put their hands up if they want to ask a question, a microphone will come to them. Could briefly state who they are and what their affiliation is. And then also, for preference, direct the question to a particular member of the panel. That would be great. If we could start down here.
Hi, my name is Matthew Assad. I'm a student at LLC, and I had a question for Adair and also for Patrick, and it was regard to the pension funds that you guys alluded to. And while there is no method for actual transmission of funds, would it not be the case that countries with unfunded pensions might have actual extra inflationary pressures? So when it came to the ECB Governing Council, they might be in favor of increasing the interest rate.
Well, yes. I mean, I think the point is that bailout is a subtle and important problem, and it occurs. It was, after all, the major reason for the Stability Pact, and it was Germany pushed it very hard because it was afraid it would have to deal with Italy's state financial problems. So it's a very serious problem. The mechanisms by which it occur could be the monetary mechanisms you're talking about. It could be more in terms of, well, you've got very close relations, you know, do you want a fellow member to fail? And this would come through the political process. So I think the bailout problem is a difficult one, and the fact that there is this state pension problem, and I don't really mind whether it's babies or not, quite frankly, Adair. You know, the fact that Italy doesn't have babies and Germany and France don't and we do, the fact is they don't, and therefore they got a problem, or for whatever other reason. And it is a state problem, and therefore it's susceptible of that political bailout process.
I think the issue you've got to address is whether it is an issue that you can deal with. I mean, I would accept with Patrick that in extremis, you could imagine, I think it's pretty indirect, not, I think, anything where we transfer money to pay it. I just don't think that is going to occur within the political economy of Europe. You could, I suppose, imagine some pressure for a slightly higher rate of inflation than it would otherwise be. Since, however, I start from the proposition that the ECB has far too low an inflation rate, that's not one that's not one that too worries me. I think, though, the bit that should give us reassurance is actually, although these are huge liabilities, they are extraordinarily sensitive to one maneuver, which is changing the state pension age. The size of pension liabilities, the degree of sensitivity with moving state pension ages from 65 to 67 or something like that, I think would surprise people. I'm therefore of the belief that there is our political processes, a political economy, whereby these things will be solved and will not end up as being unmet liabilities or liabilities which can only be met by inflation. But I guess I would admit, we're in the process of being honest here, that if there is any danger, it lies through that indirect mechanism of a country with a large set of liabilities being slightly more favourable to a higher rate of inflation than a country with a lower set of liabilities.
Yeah, there's another one down at the front here, the yellow star.
Thank you. Good evening. My name's Philip Souter from the Young Federal Union, and I'd just like to try and highlight a trend that I think that we've got, that the quality of life suffers when, in the UK, it suffers when we lag behind our sort of trailblazing brothers on the continent. And I think you can measure this in sort of chunks of roughly about 20 years, and you saw that when we didn't join the common market, we suffered for about 20 years afterwards. And I think it's unfortunately that economists tend to look at the world in very mathematical ways, and you can just go to the continent and see that the roads are better, people have a better quality of life. You might have a fundamental disagreement about what sort of social policy you'd like, whether you'd like a high-spending government or not, but people on the continent tend to have a higher quality of life. And Patrick says that Belgium has probably no chance of running an independent monetary policy. Do we honestly think that Britain has such a chance in 20 years with the rise of China, South America, and Russia, where Britain's share of global productivity and product will decline, and it will become what Belgium is now in the world in 20 years? And that's to Patrick.
No, that's for me. Okay. Well, I'll leave trailblazing to you. And say that we're talking about monetary union here. There are lots of reasons why Britain fell behind after the war, and I really don't want to go into them, and a lot of them were to do with the fact we pursued some pretty stupid policies. But you ask the main question you ask is, can we have an independent monetary policy looking 20 years ahead? Yes. I mean, of course. And in order to have an independent monetary policy, you have to have an independent exchange rate, because that's the thing that acts as the barrier, if you like, between interest rates at home and abroad. And it doesn't really matter however many Chinas there are in the world economy. Independent monetary policy, that's not going to upset the fundamental rules of monetary economics. The world has changed a lot in 500 years. That rule of monetary economics has never been... they are orthogonal. Those developments are orthogonal to that rule of monetary economics. And that's the issue, really. The macro issue is, do you want to give up that ability to control your economy? And clearly, in the case of the UK, we are a very different economy, facing very different shocks, very different structures. And indeed, this has been a common theme throughout the discussions on the euro. I mean, most people who have discussed the euro have agreed that of the various possible, as it were, optimal currency areas you could come up with, there was the little German group around Germany, and then was Italy part of it? Everybody agreed that certainly the UK wasn't by any stretch. And the fundamental reason is probably because of our very large trading relationships with the dollar area. And when I mentioned 56% of our trade was outside the euro, that is with the dollar area. And the point is that those, I think it was Adair that said that the next one is 15% of our trade, but this is missing the point, that most of the world outside the euro area links very carefully to the dollar. China has a policy, for example, of complete rigidity against the dollar. Hong Kong has a currency board with the dollar, and so on and so forth. They have more or less some modest degrees of flexibility in some cases against the dollar, but fundamentally what we're dealing with is a dollar area, and that is a very important area to us. And it, as Roger said, it's such an important trading partner, the dollar area, in these days, particularly of the death of distance. So that's the point, and that's why the monetary economics case will remain.
Adair, do you want to come in quickly on?
Can I just make two points on that? Firstly, I think that's overstating the importance of the dollar area. It is true that many countries, you've got to distinguish two things. Whether countries use the dollar as a unit of account in the way that they price and quote a price to you, a price which then survives for a short-term period of time, which is you might well do if you were buying something out of Korea or the Philippines, etc., versus whether their fundamental cost relativity to yours is driven by the value of the dollar versus the value of their own currency.
And if you move to the latter, which is the fundamental economic risk rather than the currency in which you happen to bill and make a short-term commitment to a fixed price, then most of Southeast Asia, which we're talking about, is not in a dollar area. Most of them actually have floating rates against the dollar. China is an interesting one. I always think it's interesting for those who are against fixed exchange rate regimes to note the extraordinary success of the Chinese economy, which for the last 10 years has been not only running a complete single currency within an area of 1.3 billion people, but has also chosen to have complete fixity against the US as well. An interesting example of a country which is doing very well without the benefits of a floating exchange rate.
But that's
another issue. I think, though, I also just want to say a thing about this death of distance thing. I mean, I do think we overstate this. Actually, throughout the world, for the last 20 years, the most rapidly growing trade has always been intra-regional trade. The US's most rapidly growing trade is not actually with Southeast Asia. It's been with Mexico, pushed along by NAFTA. The most rapidly growing trade in Latin America, not nearly enough, is with other Latin American countries, in Europe, with European countries. And indeed, the most rapidly growing trade in Southeast Asia is with other Southeast Asian countries. And that's because, actually, there may be death of distance, but there's also just-in-time delivery. There's also requirement in retail for rapid fashion response. And the death of distance stuff is all very well, but if the death of distance takes the form of the ability to provide from Bangalore airline reservation services, you have to realize that the same technology which makes that possible, which is information and communications technology, also tends to drive a dramatic falling at relative price of that activity, which keeps it small as a percent of GDP, which is not the case with Benetton just-in-time delivered fashion goods, which are actually subject to rising relative price rather than falling relative price. So I do think death of distance is one of those phrases that we have which does not actually survive more careful look at what's going on in the world.
Okay, the gentleman in the middle.
My name is John Preston. I'm from Kingston University. That's Kingston-on-Thames, accessible from Waterloo Station, also the gateway to the continent, whether or not there is a fog in the channel. I would like to look at this debate as having three choices, because there's the status quo where we seem to be dithering, and then there's the choice as to whether we stay with the pound or whether we change from the pound to the common currency with the euro. And I'm wondering whether I could invite the speakers to answer the question slightly differently in terms of a government which had made up its mind which to do, but what it should do to overcome the disadvantages of the decision which it had made.
Was that clear?
Definitely a question for Richard.
If only I knew what they had decided to do. What? Well, that's not going to do that. So that we can forget that option. so then we have essentially the option that they've decided to join the euro whenever they can win a referendum. And that's really where we are. But I mean, I agree with some of the things which Adair Turner said earlier about trying to use the intervening time to make the show which we join more attractive. Whether that's possible, I'm a little doubtful. I mean, it seems to me that one of the strongest arguments for joining the euro as soon as possible is that our economy is profoundly affected by what happens in Europe, whether we're in the euro or not. And therefore, it would be very good if we could have some influence on the way in which the euro is run. And that's a strong argument for getting in, because it may be that you can influence it more when you're in than when you're out, or even negotiating getting in.
Okay, there are quite a lot of questions, so if I can ask people to try and be quite quick in the question and the response. There's one upstairs. Go ahead.
Is this on?
Yeah.
My name is Katinka Barish. I work for the Centre for European Reform. I have a question to Roger Bootle about the difference in economic performance between the continent and the United Kingdom in recent years. Would you agree with me that, I mean, although exports out of the German, French, and Italian economy are still performing very well, it's a question of domestic demand. Now, domestic demand in the UK has obviously been much stronger. Would you agree that that might have something to do with the housing price bubble in this country? And would you agree that one of the reasons for the housing price bubble is that people get overly excited about historically low interest rates in the combination with flexible rate mortgages? And where does this high share of flexible rate mortgages come from? Obviously from a long history of macroeconomic instability, as successive governments in this country have used economic policy to win election. Now this is obviously over, because you now have a rules-based economic framework, rules-based fiscal policy, an independent central bank, just as the Eurozone has rules-based fiscal policy and an independent central bank. So does it then not boil down to the question, which is the better macroeconomic rules-based framework? And although coming from the country that has designed much of the current stupid economic framework for the Eurozone, I have some sympathy for the line that you and the Treasury seem to be putting forward, that the Eurozone should join Britain rather than the other way around. Is that not debatable?
Roger.
I think you began, if I can return to your beginning, by saying that you were from the Centre for European Reform. You're obviously very busy. You touch on the housing market and the problems that's created. Now, I want to be no defender of the current situation with regard to the UK housing market, but I don't think it's fair to say that the superior performance in the UK is solely due to this recent burst of consumer spending and associated with the housing bubble. After all, I gave you the figures going back actually to 1992. There's been now a very long period, during which, of course, at the beginning of that period, actually, it was a housing bust, funnily enough. There's been a long period now, I think, of successful macro management in the UK, and in particular, successful stimulation of domestic demand. Now, if we think about the German situation, and you briefly alluded to this, it is broadly characterized as one in which external demand has been relatively successful propellant of the economy overall, and domestic demand has been very weak. Consumption has been particularly weak. But the problem is that the German authorities have no way of stimulating that within the existing form of the monetary union. And that is a critical problem. If we were in their circumstances within the union, we'd be stuck with the same problem.
Okay, let me take another question. Francesco, you were in there some minutes ago.
Thank you. Francesco Giavazzi. I'm the citizen of a country with an unfunded pension system, eagerly waiting for Patrick Minford to pay my pension. But I have a question for the pro-Euro side. I have a doubt about your position, because I think that there is an illusion in the pro-Euro camp in the UK today. You keep saying, we admit that the conditions may not be satisfied by now, but there are a couple of minor things that have to be fixed, and maybe next year or the year after we can join. I think this is not what, it's an illusion, because this is not what the five tests that this government has put to itself are about. The five tests ask, is it in the long-term interest of this country to be a member of the monetary union? And if the answer next week or 2 weeks from now will be no, it is not, it's not something that can be reversed next year, because the long-term interest is there next year as it is today. So I think one has to have the courage to say it is in the long-term interest today, or it is not. To say let's wait and fix a couple of things and address the issue next year, it's an illusion.
Well, I personally agree with that very strongly. As I say, I think the only factor which is holding people back is the feeling that they couldn't win a referendum. Why could they not win a referendum? It's a very curious situation. They couldn't win a referendum because the European economy happens to be in a rather more serious downturn than the British economy. In spite of the long-term trends, where I don't accept what Roger said, I think any fair assessment of the long-term trends would make it look very similar in output per head in Britain and the Euroland. But the extraordinary feature of the situation is that the public thinks
we couldn't join because Europe is doing badly and that might pull us down. But the Treasury, I suspect, will say difficult for us to join now because the European interest rates are too low and that would make us do too well. So you get caught from either side, and this is my feeling of this, the absolute essence of the situation now, is that the Eurosceptic camp can produce an argument from either side in relation to almost any issue. For example, I read a very interesting article in The Economist, some of you may have read it a few months ago, the housing situation. We shouldn't join because we couldn't control the housing bubble if we were in. But also we shouldn't join because after the bubble has burst, we would not be able to reactivate the economy as a result of the bust. So you take any issue and you find that there are two completely contradictory arguments, both of which can be made to point against joining. So it's like Morton's fork. You may remember Morton was a cardinal who used to go along to a rich man, and either the rich man was spending too well, in which case he said he could pay higher taxes, or he was obviously living economically, in which case he also said he could pay higher taxes. And I think that's where we're at in this debate.
Okay. There's one, Stefan.
My name is Stefan Collignon from the LSE. I guess the problem with fog is that you don't see clearly. And the arguments I've heard about the German economy are rather original, I think. If there is a problem with Germany, it has to do with the fact that they did a takeover and merged with a company that had no assets, but they paid a lot for it, and they are still paying for it. Today, the average return on capital in Germany is one of the rate of return on capital in Germany is the lowest rate in the European Union. It's about 2/3 of what it is in, say, the UK. To think that you could stimulate that by manipulating the interest rates by another quarter of or half a percentage point is just beyond reality. What we do see, in fact, is that when the central bank, the ECB cut interest rates, the French economy responded much more flexible and more expansively than the German economy. What Germany needs are structural reforms to handle the problem, the severe structural problem of unification, and has absolutely nothing to do with the macroeconomic policy mix. If anything, the great liberator for Germany has been the abolition of the Bundesbank, because the ECB is much more accommodating and much more demand stimulating than the Bundesbank ever has been. And if you don't believe it, just look at the ratio of years when Germany had positive output gaps to the number of years when it had negative output gaps. And that ratio is 1-4. Which means really a severely over-restrictive monetary policy has been hampering German growth for 20 years.
Okay, Roger.
Well, I'm told by Patrick that this is one for me. I don't want to pretend that reunification didn't have a major costs and problems for the German economy. Clearly it did. Nor do I want to pretend that there aren't significant structural problems in Germany. There clearly are. But I think your position amounts to saying something much more than that, which is that in Germany, monetary policy just doesn't work. You might as well not have an independent monetary policy, and that's where I take issue with you. It's like the position where a car has been knocked off the motorway, not by, as it were, steering badly, but by a lorry coming and bashing right into it, and you're saying you should sit there on the hard shoulder and say, well, now what I must do is try and reverse the fact that the lorry hit me onto the hard shoulder. No, you actually start using the steering wheel. You start from where you are. You start to use the tools you've got. And the point about Germany is that it hasn't. Now, that's not to say that, you know, that even that the main part of Germany's problems is deficient demand. I think probably if I had to rank them crudely, I'd say that the main problem is probably structural. But to go back to where I was before, given that where you are, you know, do you think that monetary policy is going to have some effect on the situation of domestic demand in Germany? I think the evidence is quite clearly yes.
Okay, we've got a 7:45 closure time, which I'm going to keep to. That gives us time for a few more questions before asking the panelists to wrap up. There's one up there.
Hello, my name is Ali.
And then another one. So let's take two up there fairly quickly. Yeah.
Okay, I'm Ali, I'm a student. Seeing how the manufacturing industry is in a desperate need for a lower valued pound, and many economists see that the future of the manufacturing industry is nil if we do not join the euro, I was wondering what, this is a question to Patrick, by the way, I was wondering what you have to say about the tens of thousands of jobs, or even the hundreds of thousands, that have been lost or will be lost as a result of the decision not to join the euro.
Can I put you on hold a second?
Yeah, sure,
Patrick? Let's take
sure,
another question sure. up there. And if there are any more... Yeah, let's take three from the... Yeah, go sure. ahead. Three go from on. The top.
My question is directed toward Roger Bootle. Do you feel that you've underestimated the importance of price transparency? For instance, in the past 20 years, during periods when the Deutsche Mark would appreciate against the lira, a lot of German citizens would go to Italy and make major purchases and come back to Germany with cars, for instance. And subsequently, the German government lost hundreds of millions of euros in taxes.
I think it's really a question for Patrick, actually.
Okay, well, let's take another one from up here and then... Yeah,
good. Oh, hi. It's not really a question, it's a comment, and it's actually to all five of you, the team, because I don't actually see you as opponents. All I would say is I think, you know, in terms of the argument, you can't really mix and match. I think you've either got to decide, are you making your arguments within the context of accepting that we do live and function in a political economy, or are you going to abstract from that, which is why we keep hearing from all of you, from all of the audience, discussions about theory, hastily followed by discussions about reality. That's the only comment I wanted to make.
I think I'm going to just stack up some more questions and then roll these up into concluding remarks for everyone. Is that?
Sure.
Yeah. So that gives us quite a lot. Let's start down here. People are going to be very brief, because yes, I doubt everyone's going to get in. But if you
okay, my name is Peter Fellner. It's really to do with the mix between the politics and the economics. I mean, do the panel basically believe that you can run a monetary union without eventual sort of political unification? And if you come onto the question of political unification, don't you come back to the problem that we've just seen highlighted by the divisions over the Iraq situation? I would guess that quite a lot of the UK population are probably alienated from voting yes in a referendum by the division between the politics that the UK's been pursuing and the politics that the European Union, as sort of depicted by Chirac and Schroeder, have done. So if you believe there are doubts on the political front, surely one must have doubts about the entire question, and I think that really hasn't been highlighted enough.
Okay, if you could just pass the microphone along.
If I could just briefly follow that up, I'm Robert Guy, born in Rothschild for 26 years, I'm chairman of Citi in Europe. Can I just have a bit more political vision from all the panelists? There's been much debate over interpretation of various figures, various economic consequences, but I hear nothing about what actually the political aspirations of the panelists are, whether in fact they want to see a more integrated Europe, or whether they want to see a fully federal Europe. I myself don't. But can we just have a bit of political vision as to where they want to see Europe to be in the next few years, bearing in mind that even now we've got many new countries joining the European Union who in a matter of years, a few years in some cases, will wish to become members of Economic Monetary Union. And where will that leave the United Kingdom then when we are still outside it?
Okay, there are two there and they're the last two.
Gregory Ho from Radio Free Asia. This question is for the poll Eurochem. I want to ask, how big is the advantage if we combine the strengths of the UK dollar with the euros, especially at this juncture when the US is so weak? Say in 10 years or 15 years, will we have a super euro dollar, which will be more will be stronger than the US dollar, and then the Euro ECB can use the Euro as a machine to adjust the world economy. How big is the advantage if we combine the strengths of Euro and pounds, especially at this juncture when the US dollar is weak? And for the Eurosceptics, is it possible this dream can become true?
Mm-hmm. Okay, one last at the back.
Anthony O'Keefe, in a utopian future, if the Welsh Assembly and the Scottish Parliament had control of fiscal policies, one word answer from the team members, would they still hold the same opinions if they were members of that Assembly or Parliament? So, in a utopian future, okay, where the Welsh Assembly and the Scottish Parliament had control of fiscal policy and the panel members were members of those assemblies or parliaments, would they be in favour of the euro or against?
For Britain or for Wales or for Scotland or for...
For the regional...
For those regional... Right.
Okay, let's... the vast amount of... the questions and points to respond to. I'm going to start with Richard and ask people to spend 2 minutes reacting in the order in which we kicked off. Richard.
Well, I'm an internationalist. My answer to the first question is in one word, since you asked for one word, yes, the last question. But we were asked what our general political positions are. I think that's a fair question. I think that the issue of war and peace is one of the most important facing mankind, and that we are more likely to have peace if there are fewer numbers of countries involved, so the differences get settled inside countries rather than outside countries. So in a broad way, I am in favour of movement towards a European common foreign and defence policy and even a European army. But I don't think that should get confused with one's views about the merits of monetary union, which is a rather particular and almost in a way on one side issue compared with the things which have been done so far in the building up of European cooperation and the movement towards common foreign and defence policy. So I think it is good that monetary policy is looked upon as a technical matter. And this has been the great success in Britain of the independence of the Bank of England. And I think it will be the great success of the independence of the European Central Bank. It doesn't mean to say that, of course, there won't be more fiscal coordination amongst countries in their discussions with the European Central Bank, as in the Ken and Eddie show. But I think that it should be argued out on its economic merits. Last point I want to make is I do think it's completely, to my mind, the most interesting thing that's happened this evening is this complete disregard of geography on the part of the anti-euro camp and this absolutely extraordinary belief that somehow the world is becoming one and who you happen to be near doesn't matter. You're just as happy to get onto a plane and fly to South Korea as you are to go to Paris. Of course, it's not like that, and that's why services will always have a strong geographical dimension and probably a more strong geographical dimension than goods. But it's also the reason why goods trade is still so geographically directed. When you listen to the Eurosceptics, you feel that basically they think it's a mistake that we trade 50% with Europe and 16% with America. Somehow, we made a mistake. And we ought to have ignored the 4,000 miles of the Atlantic, because after all, they speak the same language over there. It just shows this power of geography, the fact that although they speak the same language over there, we trade in the opposite direction. And as Adair really importantly pointed out, in spite of all these global trends that have been mentioned, our share of trade with Europe has risen and risen and risen, and that is something which is unlikely to be reversed.
Thank you, Richard. Patrick.
Well, thank you. I'm a Eurosceptic, of course, and obviously I don't... Richard is left unbelieving by my remarks, but I'm also an internationalist, and I think that the vision I have politically is of a world in which many successful nations, which is, after all, the unit in which most people like to be governed, such as Australia, such as Thailand, and if such as Japan, I mean, these, if you were to say to Japan or to Korea, because you're next to Japan, you better unite with Korea, you know, or with Japan, or to the Japanese, you better unite with Korea. I mean, they'd be completely thinking you're out of your mind. And I think this is the difficulty. People like Richard, because they stress war and peace and so on, which strikes me as quite flimsy. I mean, we had a war a long time ago, you know. Keep on bringing it up, you know. Not supposed to talk about the war, are we? I mean, it's beyond belief that this is being trotted out today as a reason for being closely knit with a bunch of people we fundamentally disagree with on everything under the sun. I mean, we just had an illustration of it. Now, it's quite clear that the vast majority of British people, of which I am one, would like to be involved with Europe as a Europe of cooperating countries with treaty arrangements. And certain areas we cooperate, in other areas we say, fine, we disagree, go and do your own thing. That, I think, is the vision that my fellow countrymen have, you know, which is why Richard and his Islington types find it so difficult, to win a referendum, you know, because poor old sun readers like me, you know, we say, well, blow it, guys. We actually quite like the country we've got, and we'd like to run it. We've got all these links with all over the world. And, of course, that's why I said that the reason it's an economic debate here is the only way you can sell Europe to the Brits is on the basis of economic advantage, because fundamentally they don't buy into this vision. And so the vision is clear that Eurosceptics, like the majority of my fellow citizens, we have a vision of a world of free nations getting about their global trading business. Comparative advantage, you know? Things that our chairman knows a lot about. And it's got nothing to do with economies of scale, going and getting into the German economy for chasing economies of scale. It's about having an efficient economy and exploiting your comparative advantage. That's the vision we have. Now, of course, that vision means that the argument's got to be won on economics. And it's a pretty hard argument to win, I think, as we wretched Eurosceptics may have demonstrated tonight. There are a lot of serious problems here. The manufacturing, the overvalued pound, the euro will not cure the problems of manufacturing in the UK. Transparency, well, you know, to compare prices, you need a calculator. Transparency is important if you've got to do them very quickly. That's why it's important in border areas. Otherwise, you get a calculator, you get a computer, and that's true of these business things as well. And so at the end of the day, if I was in the Welsh Assembly and I'm just about to vote for it, I would say, yes, stay out of the euro, guys. Stay out of the euro. It's a bad idea for economic reasons.
Adair.
Well, I think the interesting question was posed is, does monetary union require political union, and are you in favour of political union? My response to that is I'm just not sure what political union means, or at least I don't believe it's an either-or thing in the way that most people put it. The European Union involves us already sharing aspects of sovereignty or aspects of political power. Our trade policy in the UK is not a UK trade policy, it's a European trade policy, and that seems to be a perfectly sensible thing to do. Our environmental policy in the UK is fundamentally, in an awful lot of its aspects, not a UK-specific environmental policy. It is actually, in large aspects, a European environmental policy, and this seems to me a remarkably sensible thing to do, since, you know, nasty things like sulfur dioxide tend to go across borders and don't recognise them very well. So we share aspects of sovereignty in the European Union, just as indeed in NATO we shared very significant aspects of sovereignty in terms of the control of major nuclear assets. The issue is, does monetary union obviously entail sharing one other aspect of sovereignty, right? The interest rate element. Does it carry with it other things? Well, before I answer that, let me say, is there anything ultimate about sovereignty? The only ultimate thing about sovereignty is the right to secede, right? If you've got the right to secede, you are sovereign, i.e. to reverse the decision you previously made. If you haven't got the right to secede, you're not sovereign.
That is why I support the fact that in the Constitutional Convention of Europe being put forward at the moment, there will be, in the initial preambles, a clear statement of a right to secede. Provided you've got that, you're simply making a set of decisions about what policies, at least for the foreseeable future, you share and which not. Does monetary union, does it require that from interest rate policy, we also have social policy, we also have tax policy, etc., etc.? No, it doesn't. And it certainly doesn't entail that we definitely have foreign and security policy harmonised. I think we could harmonise foreign and security policy while we were out of the euro, and I think we could go into the euro and not harmonise foreign and security policy. So, as it happens, I am a tiny bit more pro-European and less Eurosceptic than Patrick. I'm a little bit more willing to accept degrees of integration. I think there are some political reasons to get try and be more unified in a foreign policy, though I would not be very optimistic about rapid progress on that after the last few months. But I think it is really a separate issue from the issue of monetary union for and against. That's why I think the economics are very important. I think that's why it's very important that debates like this, we get away from inevitability, sovereignty, trains leaving stations, etc., because I think there are some important economics to debate. The economics, I think, come back to the micro and supply side case, which I think is strongly pro, and the trade-offs and difficulties in the macro case, where there are dangers, and there are dangers which I think do mean that we have to think very carefully about the specific design of the ECB going forward. But I guess where I'm in the optimistic camp, that the problems that exist, and that's where I agree with Roger, I do think there are faults within the design structure of the ECB's targets. I think they can be fixed, and I think our objective as a country should be to make sure that we achieve the changes required to make the euro a success, rather than to keep out of it. But I do think it's an important issue to debate, rather than saying that we can resolve it by a set of high-level political statements.
Roger. Briefly, on the question of political vision, I think my major problem, or my major issue about this, is that I think that the shape of Europe, the future possibilities of Europe, have been transformed by the fall of communism. And it's as though really the European elites have not woken up fully to the consequences of that. It was relatively easy, I think, to envisage a fairly closely unified structure of the old six and then tagging on a few extra countries on board. But once you open up the whole of the former Eastern Europe and you don't even know where the borders of this union are going to be, are they eventually going to include Russia and Turkey and North Africa and heaven knows where else? I think the idea of a closely integrated entity of that sort is frankly a pipe dream, or it may be more like a nightmare. So I think that given that I accept Dare's points about common interests in both the political field and the environmental field, I accept all that, I'm drawn towards a vision of variable geometry, essentially, that you don't have all parts of Europe proceeding to the same level of integration simultaneously. And I would judge as part of that that our interests would be in staying outside monetarily, although cooperating fully on stuff like environment and so on and so forth. The only other point I wish to come back on from the general discussion is the points about the end of geography or the denigration of geography, and the point that Adair made about saying that the fastest growth of trade was in fact in trade of closely geographical related areas like Mexico and the United States. That may be true for goods, but of course it's not true that goods trade overall has been expanding fast in relation to services and investment flows. The fastest expansion of international financial flows have been concerned with investment and services. And moreover, it's no surprise, surely, that goods trade has expanded most in those countries that are geographically close to one another, because those are the countries that have entered into trade agreements, free trade agreements, partly under the drive, you see it in NAFTA, see it in all sorts of other areas. And the last point I'd make is in response to someone who I think has since left, who raised the point about UK monetary sovereignty. What would it be like in the world of the future when countries like China and India are very, very important? It seems to me that the thrust of that point goes in exactly the opposite direction to the one that he was trying to make. I quite agree. China and India are going to be much, much more important in the world economy than they currently are. But what's the implication of that? The implication of it is surely going to be that Britain's trade with Europe as a proportion of the total is going to be much lower. The outside world, the non-European world, is going to become much more important. And that's the sense in which I, like Richard Layard, I think would like to count myself an internationalist.
Good. It's a debate that will continue. Let us thank all the panelists for an entertaining and illuminating evening.